Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We'd all like to think we know our dogs. Cognitive psychologist Alexandra Horowitz has made a science of it. The way the world looks and sounds and smells to a dog may be more different than you imagine. This hour, On Point, inside the mind and senses of a dog. There they are now, all around us. Joining me, at least on tape, joining me now from New York is Alexandra Horowitz. She teaches psychology at Barnard College, where she also studies canine behavior at a dog cognition laboratory. Her new book is Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. Alexandra Horowitz, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You quote Groucho Marx, or at least what's attributed to him right off the bat, outside of a dog, a book is a man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read. Is it still you've been probing around in there?
I think it's still a little bit opaque. I don't know if we'll ever get a clear view in there, but I think with a little bit of scientific understanding, we can get a better glimpse.
Well, Madam Scientist, when you got into this, dogs were not on your agenda. You're right. You're a dog person, but you thought that, you know, just dogs were just too what? Too known, too familiar. You went off and studied white rhinoceros and bonobo, you know, pygmy chimpanzees. Why not dogs at the beginning?
As a matter of fact, nobody was studying dogs as cognitively interesting, at least not in academics. There are plenty of people who are dog trainers, do dog behaviorism. But nobody in academics was researching the mind of the dog. And I think that's because we were just too familiar with them. And, you know, I had a dog myself, Pumpernickel, who I talk about somewhat in the book. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a jumping off point for me to do some of this research, but it didn't actually occur to me that she could be, or her compeers could be, scientific subjects.
But we think we know a lot about dogs, 75 million of them or so in this country. People spend a lot of time with them, a lot of people anyway. And we have the sense that we understand dogs pretty well. You write, Alexandra, you say, you know, go look at a dog, take a good look, and now forget everything you know about this or any dog. Why?
I think that's a good start because we come with a fair set of assumptions about what dogs are like, which are really not validated or in some cases justified at all. And those assumptions deserve a relook. And the best way to do that is to try to forget what a dog is like, what a breed of dog is supposed to be like, and instead just start observing the dog as though it were an alien creature. And I think what we see when we do that is surprising.
So if we come in with assumptions, maybe they're different by breed, but broad stroke, when you look at Homo sapiens and how they look at dogs, what are the big overriding assumptions we come in with that may or may not be correct?
We really treat them as though they're furry, small, less intelligent humans, I think. I mean, we anthropomorphize, essentially, which is a natural thing for us to do.
And a lot of fun.
And we do it, I think, almost with infants, too. You know, we attribute a lot to those creatures, human or otherwise, whose behavior we can't otherwise explain. And as a result, we assume that animals have all sorts of emotions, that they really understand a lot of what we're talking about, that they see the universe in the same way that we do. Some of that might be true, but it's not yet proven.
So let's just dive in here. I've got a little tape of dogs playing. Maybe it's not a bad place to begin. This is a very big dog and a very small dog playing with a tug toy. The small dog's making all the noise. Maybe you can listen and begin to give us a little scientific interpretation or just one angle of what's going on with dogs. Okay, dog's playing, and clearly it's a little dog, clearly making all the noise. What's going on there that we might not understand, Alexandra?
You know, I wish I could interpret their barks and growls, although, you know, translations for those have never really been forthcoming.
Yeah.
But what's happening in the play is that two creatures of entirely disparate sizes have essentially agreed, probably through using play signals, some of which might have been vocalizations, that all these sounds they're making are not aggressive. Instead, they're all in the context of enjoying each other's company. And so they're communicating with each other constantly, and they constantly have to reaffirm that with each other, else it devolves into aggression.
That this is theater, right? This is theater. This is theater. The little dog, the big dog are both saying again and again.
Yeah, right. And they have to say that again and again, and especially if they're of different sizes. And that big dog wasn't being the big vocalizer, incidentally, and that might be because larger dogs tend to self-handicap. They don't show all their cards. They don't show all their moves in play with a smaller dog. Instead, they refrain from being too aggressive, being too loud. Sometimes they'll throw themselves on the ground at the mercy of the small dog in order to equalize the game.
We're going to have a lot of listeners who have gained a lot of experience with dogs. They're going to be listening and sort of judging your assessment, no doubt. So give us a sense how you came to your – we'll dive into a bunch of different insights about dogs. But how did you come to these? Is this in a dog lab? I mean, it's white rats that get all the attention in labs. Did you really put dogs in labs? That, first of all, that doesn't sound like a lot of fun for the dog. But how did you come to your insight?
My own research has been in two methods. One, natural, what is just called natural observation or ethological methods, where I went and watched dogs, in fact, in social play, at play with each other, videotaped them, then carefully observed in frame by frame analysis what was happening, what they were saying to each other, what the result was, etc. And I did that for thousands of hours of dog play. And then the other type of research, of which mine is only a small part, this is budding group of dog cognition researchers, is experimental, where owners come in with their dogs and dogs participate in a little test of object permanence or following a point to see where food is hidden, things like that, in a laboratory, but usually with their owners.
Let's start with what you learned from that about their relationship with humans. I mean, it seems to be one of the things that sets dogs apart, perhaps above all others, what you call their fluent travel between our social world, their own social world, and that of humans. Talk to us about origins and about the shape of the dog mind or evolution that has situated them to do that.
Well, there are a couple of ways to answer that question, I guess. One is, what was the evolutionary origin? And there's still a debate about how dogs came to be domesticated. It looks like they probably were loiterers on the outskirts of our civilizations some tens or 20,000 years ago.
And when you scavengers. Say they 10,000 years ago, were they wolves at that time?
They were probably a wolf-like ancestor, not exactly the wolf we see today, but an ancestor of today's wolf.
Okay.
And they might have been slightly more friendly or agreeable than other wolves. They weren't as strong hunters, maybe more scavengers. And those ancient peoples maybe took a few of the dogs into their community, tolerated them, maybe sometimes ate them if necessary. Mm-hmm. And
still do some places.
Mm-hmm. Over time started to selectively allow reproduction of those who pleased them. And the things that would please them is the other way to answer your question. Those elements of this proto-dog, which are sort of human-like in some ways. And one of the big elements is their gaze. They're looking in our eyes, something which we look for in infants, something which allows us to bond with infants.
Something wolves don't do, you say.
Among wolves, a direct gaze is perceived as a threat. So they don't sit there looking each other in the eyes fondly. If two wolves are locking gaze, a fight is about to ensue. Among dogs, there could still be a threat, but dogs will look right in the face of humans, as all owners know, as though adoringly gazing into our eyes. And I think that's very appealing. And that might have allowed some dogs, the dogs who had the propensity to do that, to survive long enough to reproduce. Then their young are a little more likely to be tame and to look us in the eye. And over time, we start selectively choosing those dogs. And lo and behold, they become domesticated.
So we got the loiterers and the scavengers, perhaps, in the evolutionary chain. What is going on when they gaze with what appears to be adoration into human eyes?
Well, I think they're looking to us for cues about what we're going to do. I mean, the result has been that they're very good predictors of our behavior, and they see that our face, and in particular our eyes, give a lot of information about what we're about to do. We turn our face and our eyes to where we're about to go. We change attention just with our face or with our gaze, which is something a little bit different than most animals. Most animals, if they want to look at something over to the right, turn their whole bodies off to the right. They don't just turn their eyes to the right. And so by gazing at us in our eyes, they're getting some information about what we're about to do. And that's often involves food. It often involves taking them someplace. They become pretty good predictors of our behavior.
And it involves what comes next. You've got a fascinating section here on dogs smelling time. We will come back and look at that and talk, I think, a lot more about dogs. Listeners lining up with questions, but I've got one here right off the bat. Here's a little tape. It's very short, but this is, I'm told, this, I haven't heard this yet, but the sound of a dog laughing sounds a bit like panting. Let's listen, and then maybe you can tell us about dogs and laughter. Here we go. Okay, that was short and sweet, but you asked, do dogs laugh? What's the answer?
I think this type of play panting is a kind of laughter. Dogs do it when they're playing, when they're enjoying themselves. They can even do this particular pant in order to induce play. You could do this sort of panting to your dog and probably get them to perk up their
ears. Start running in circles
and
jumping.
With you. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. And the researcher who did this work calls it laughter. I think that's not far off. We've seen in other species like rats that when you listen to them with the right kind of acoustic device, you can hear a little chirping when they play or are tickled. And that's a kind of laughter, too.
And give us the big picture. I mean, you're prepared to look at everything that a dog thinks and perceives and senses and begin to talk about an entire umwelt, a kind of entire worldview of a dog or manner of perceiving the world. That's big characterization. Compare it to ours.
Oh, our umwelts are hugely different, I think. This concept of an umwelt, the worldview, how the dog sees the world, or how anyone sees the world, is based on what their sensory equipment is. And I think dogs live in a kind of sensory parallel universe to ours, where their universe has a topography of what are to us invisible smells, quick motion, things that are lickable or not, things that fit in the mouth or are too big to fit in the mouth. Our umwelt is visual. You know, we open our eyes and that's how we start the day and see the world. So imagine having a world which is made up of smells instead of images. That's just to begin how it's different from ours.
We'll go to that. It takes us to the issue of time, and it's interesting. Let's get a caller here from Los Angeles, California. Saad, you're on the air with Alexander Horowitz.
Yes, hi, Tom. Fascinating topic. My question is about the affection emotions that dogs display. We know that the human beings have a limbic system, which is responsible for emotions, anger, love. Do dogs have a similar structure in their brains? And with the topic of domestication, the more you have intimate contact with the animal, does that result in more affection, emotion, evolution-wise?
Interesting, Saad. Alexandra?
Absolutely. Dogs, like most mammals, have a limbic system, and they have amygdala, part of the limbic system, which would presumably allow them to feel pleasure, enjoyment, concern, upset. Maybe not just as we do, but analogs to the emotions that we feel. Absolutely. Whether their affection for us is the same as our affection for them, that's a harder question and one that's maybe unanswerable unless one can really get a dog to report on this. There's one nice example that I talk about where what we interpret as affection from the dog is maybe not so affectionate. And this is their licking of our faces when we come back from being away. These kisses that they give us, I certainly interpret my dog's jumping at my face and licking me around the mouth as an affectionate exercise. But if we look a little bit at wolf behavior, it looks like maybe there's another explanation for that. Wolves also greet with this kiss any wolf returning to the pack from a hunt. Now, what then happens is that that returning wolf is often prompted to regurgitate a little of that hunt for the licking dogs, licking pups. It could be that what our dog is doing is not kissing us, but asking us to regurgitate a little of the food that we've eaten since we've been gone. So sometimes the things that look most affectionate to us are in fact something else. Right. I don't think they'd be upset if you spit up a little of your sandwich.
I'm sure they wouldn't bring home the McDonald's. Well, I mean, that raises an interesting question about if there's a Venn diagram of our understanding of each other as species. How do you think we do? Do we just have a kind of natural proclivity to fit together, or is there a decent amount of understanding between human and dog here, by and large?
I'm tempted to say that dogs in some ways understand us a little better than we understand them. And I think that's because we come to the table with this, with all these assumptions about what dogs are like and what their capacities are, that isn't exactly based on observation of the animals as much as a preconceived notion. Whereas the dogs are consummate eavesdroppers on us. You know, you watch your dog across the room as you sit there on the computer, on the phone, making dinner. Your dog is watching you constantly and could, if he could articulate it, tell us a lot about our habits. So in some sense, their understanding of us is a little bit better than our understanding of them.
Wow. Carrie in Lowell, Massachusetts. Carrie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Alexandra.
Hi.
I like the name. I'm calling up to, you mentioned a lot of good things there, like affection and so forth, and other words like sort of us just opening our eyes and having pictorial things, different things like that in our mind's image, you know, in our mind. But that dog's smell, different way of input type of things, I guess. But, you know, when I was young, 14 and a half, I had a brainstem glioma, neurological problems, and now I have visual, like cortical blindness. I have a certified sight dog. And when I go out of my home and his harness is on him, that's the key. People you just leave alone, don't distract him. He works fantastic. He's great. All my dogs have. When he's home and I take the harness off of him, I mean, he's with me, goes around with me, doesn't leave me alone. I call him Pinocchio's, by the way. That's the name, Pinocchio. I never divulge a service sight dog's real name, just Pinocchio, for safety reasons, okay?
Right.
Safety reasons for the owner. Don't distract them, the key word. But I always went on to know, Alexander, and this, throughout my dogs, go, how do they view me? Do they view me as, say, the alpha wolf? Do they view me, say, as their papa? Do they view me as their buddy? That type of thing. Can you help to expand upon that and clarify it for me, please?
That's great, Carrie, and it really matters here, Alexander, in Carrie's relationship.
I think the likeliest way that your dog views you is as his charge. In other words, as his responsibility. And a little bit, therefore, as an extension of himself. So when he makes a move to cross the street or turn a corner, he is imagining that his body extends to include your body. So he's extended his sense of personal space to include you. I think that's likelier than viewing you as the alpha, because I don't think that dogs exactly think that way, despite a sort of popular conception that they view humans as alphas, and despite the fact that you will be the one giving him a lot of commands. In some ways, he's giving you commands, too. He's directing you around a visual world that you no longer have complete access to. And he's also viewing you as part of his family, as I think all dogs do. Although he has a very specific work relationship with you, you're still family members, and maybe you are a sibling in that respect.
The word that Carrie raised in opposition to the alpha wolf kind of status was buddy. Can dogs see humans as buddies?
I think that's a fair way to describe it, yeah. I think that family is a good way to describe it. My sibling, my brother, can be my buddy as well. Just as dogs have buddies in the park, buddies who they meet on the street, there's no reason to say that anyone inside the house couldn't be a buddy.
I want to go to senses. You write wonderfully about smell, of course, but also sight, and this notion that dogs can actually smell time. I was baffled by that phrasing when I first read it, but as you explain it, I came to understand it. But lay it out for us. How do dogs smell time?
My idea here, and this was in my attempt to try to get at what the world is like to a dog, you know, what the dog's experience is like, once you realize that it's full of this olfactory universe, you start to think about the characteristics of smell. Now, smells move. They decay over time. You know, they waft in from afar. They have a lifetime, in other words. It's a little different than images, visual images. When I stare at the book in front of me, you know, it continues to be there and I'm not getting any sense of its existence through time. Mm-hmm. But its smell is changing over time. Dogs are able to, they basically identify the landmarks of the world through smell, but the smells have an age in them. So they can distinguish between a footstep that was placed 10 seconds before and one was placed 15 seconds before by the concentration of the odor. So in some sense, what they're seeing in scent is the passage of time. And you see this in your dog's behavior. You know, dogs are constantly re-sniffing. They're sniffing the air.
That's
when they
true.
See each other, they're constantly, they sniff to greet, and then they continue to sniff throughout the introduction, throughout the after the formalities, you know, just in interacting with each other. And I think it's because the smell is changing over time and they're constantly getting another look at it.
So that when we as humans come onto a scene, essentially we have the visual snapshot of the moment that we are in, but the dog smells what was there and how long it's been there and may smell what's coming. It's almost like a kind of Doppler effect. But around smell here, but the fading past, but also the waft, as you say, the wafting in future, something that may be approaching, kind of extends their acuity into the future.
Yeah, exactly. So I think in some sense, what counts as the present moment is slightly different for them. Maybe a slightly expanded window of the present moment includes a little bit from up ahead, a little bit from what just happened, as contrasted with our visual moments.
I love that notion of a dog smelling time in a broader spectrum. You also say that dogs see the world faster. You might say they see it faster than we do, but what they really do is they see a bit more of the world in every second. Go to sight and the visuals of the dog and more of the world in every second. What do you mean?
What I mean there is that they have what's called a different flicker fusion rate. So, you know, we take little snapshots of the world in every second, our eyes do, and we reconstruct that as motion, and we take about 60 snapshots, the normal human eye, every second. But although we see the world is continuously moving, we don't even notice that we're taking these snapshots. The dog's flicker fusion rate is higher, so on the order of something like 70 or 80 snapshots per second. As a result, they are seeing little snapshots just a bit before we see the little snapshot. I think it allows them to do some of these preternaturally successful catches, you know, of a tennis ball, of a frisbee.
You say, how do they do that? It's because the world just looks different to them. It's not quite as bewilderingly fast to them.
They have a split second advantage on us.
And so they can grab that frisbee out of the sky or that ball in midair. That's amazing.
Like a great outfielder.
Right, like a very great outfielder. Hire a dog. Let's get a call from Sam in Hingham, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Well, speaking to that visual thing, hello, Tom.
Hi.
I had a West Highland Terrier for 16 years, and I've always had a predilection for the small terriers and Silky Terriers way back, and then for 16 years, Skeeter, who was a West Highland Terrier.
Yep.
Her visual acuity shocked everybody. Very young, we realized that she was watching her best buddy, my son Jake, when he was about 8 years old, on home videos on TV. Now, we suspected that, but then we really proved her visual acuity when we turned the camera on her, and then she saw a dog on the screen, and she would leap at the screen, start barking at it. She'd react the same way if there were deer or other things on some sort of animal program on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Going forward, some years later, we had a tenant in a house that we were renting who was a neurologist at Angel Memorial Hospital. And I told her about Skeeter's visual wonderment, and she was very skeptical. She said, well, you know, dogs react to sounds they hear on television and so forth, but it's hard to believe. So she was over one night for dinner, and we proceeded to, put Skeeter in front of the television set and put pictures, first of all, pictures of Jake.
Off the video camera,
Yeah, and then pictures of herself and then animals. And, you know, when it was friends of hers like Jake or me, on screen, she would just look at the screen and cock her head and follow the action. But when it was an animal, she'd go for the screen like nobody's business.
Did you change the doctor, the veterinarian's mind, Sam?
Absolutely. But the final quickie story on it was we were out on the boat one day, and my wife showed Skeeter a picture in a magazine. It was just like a one-inch small, smaller than a passport photo of a West Highland Terrier staring straight out, from the magazine.
Yep.
She said, Skeeter, look at this. Skeeter looked directly at the magazine and started barking at it. I mean...
Cousin Willie, Skeeter says hi. Sam, we've got to, Alexander, our time is short before the break, but... What do dogs see, and is there that great big range? I had labs and collies most of my life. A beagle now. The beagle seems to have much better eyesight than I'd seen before. Are there breed differences that are significant?
There are, and they have to do, research has found, interestingly, with the shape of the skull, the length of the nose of the breed. So a terrier with a pretty short nose actually has a lot of cells on its retina, the back of the eye, right in the center of the eye, similar to our... similar to human vision. So they see pretty well right in front of them. Not all dogs are like that. Retrievers are a lot different. Long-nosed dogs, they see a lot better across the horizon. In other words, maybe to see something running across the horizon or a ball moving across the horizon. So a terrier or a pug is likely to see something pretty clearly that's right in front of them, whereas a retriever is less likely to see that clearly.
So the pug could watch TV or, quote-unquote, read a magazine. A retriever might be scanning the horizon. This seems like an evolutionary reason for that, too. That's where the things to retrieve are.
Precisely. And a lot of people think that one reason that some of the smaller dogs or small-nosed dogs, I say, seem particularly companionable is that if they sit in your lap and stare at your face, they have you in focus. And that's agreeable to us, whereas a retriever, putting aside its size, is less likely to sit there and ogle you in the face. Instead, it's more likely to go after that ball that's bouncing across the room.
Karen in Framingham, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a fascinating topic, and I'm a child psychologist myself. But I find myself, I'm a dog lover, and I find myself worrying about learning too much. I have a wonderful relationship with my dog, and it may be all projection, but it really works for both of us. I love him, and I like to think he loves me and knows my soul and my every thought. And I'd be afraid to learn too much and find out that that's to be disabused of that notion, like the kids in Mary Poppins.
it's a great notion, Alexandra. How about it? Maybe better not to know.
Right. Yeah, I'm sympathetic to that in some sense. I mean, I don't think that all our anthropomorphisms will be undermined if we examine them carefully. For instance, I do think that they have dogs have affection for us. I mean, I think a huge amount of their behavior indicates that they do. We aren't just imagining that. But I tend to think there are other kinds of anthropomorphisms which it behooves us to look more closely at. And there is something rewarding about finding out that the world for the dog is about the nose instead of visually. And I think that does change our relationships for the better. It's interesting that the caller is a child psychologist. Mm. I think a lot of what we do to children is, especially as they're infants, over attribute to them. And that's part of our way of bonding with them, is we assume that that first smile is a smile about us, for instance. To me, knowing that it might be a smile of gas is not really a loss. You know, I think it's still charming to see the smile. But if you don't want to investigate scientifically everything that your dog is about, still, I think it's interesting to observe their behavior without too many preconceived notions about what they can do and what they know.
You've brought lab science to observing the dog. You've observed them for thousands of hours with a scientific kind of eye for it. You must also see a lot of people interacting with their dogs. Not everybody is a cognitive psychologist, but do you see that most people over time come to observe or intuit pretty accurately about their dogs and their capacity and their outlook? Or do we just bumble, you know, endlessly against the grain of the dog's real nature?
I think it's a mix. A lot of people are excellent observers of their dog, and especially are experts on their dog. They come to be familiar with what their dog can understand, the capacities of their dog. Others, I think, get caught up in what their dog is supposed to be like. For instance, they have a breed which is a friendly breed, and then it's a kind of confirmation bias. Every behavior they see of that animal looks friendly to them because that's what they believe the dog should be like. So people are a mix of that. In some sense, obviously, the preconceived notions that we have of our dogs and the anthropomorphisms that we make of our dogs can't be entirely wrong, because they have served to maintain a relationship between humans and dogs for a long time. Right. And I think that's powerful evidence that at least they're good enough in a lot of respects.
Let's go to Joe in Northampton, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Alexandra. Oh, this is so great. Please disabuse me of this alpha notion. I have a Cocker Spaniel I've had for 15 years. And when we got him, he was young. He was wonderful and playful, and we did all the wrong things. We put him on the bed with us, and, you know, we did the things we subsequently found out were bad. But he went to school twice, and they said, he's got a little alpha issue, and if he starts to get aggressive, you need to pin him down and make sure he knows who's boss. Well, he would go nuts if somebody knocked at the door and wanted to eat the door, so I put him down, and twice he bit me. So I'm wondering about this whole notion.
The alpha dog.
Right,
thanks, Joe.
Right. It's a popular conception. You can have that relationship with your dog where you act as an alpha, whatever that means, and dominate your dog, and you punish them by pinning them down, et cetera. I don't think that's the relationship most of us want to have with our dog. And it's not necessary. And it doesn't reflect actual wolf pack behavior. You know, alpha wolves aren't out there vying with the beta wolves for who gets to be in the top wolf position. Instead, they're just families, and they learn by observing. They learn by small reprimands. So you don't need to do that. And your dog probably bit you to indicate that that behavior by you was stepping over the line and probably unnecessary.
But you know how much we hear that that's not the way these days. What is it? Cesar Millan, host of the National Geographic show Dog Whisper, you know, he's always got this view that you've got to be the pack leader. I've got a little tape here. I wonder if we can listen to. You might respond. But here he is, Cesar Millan. It's an interview with Fox News, and he's talking about the psychology behind some of his methods with dogs.
Dogs want to communicate or connect with you based on how you smell, and then they feel the energy that you are projecting. So when I come into people's home, I am in a calm, assertive state. And of course, my scent tells the brain, who am I? And who I want to be is a pack leader. Most of the clients that I work with are a follower, not the dog's pack leader.
Followers, not leaders, because they're not in charge. And he's saying it makes trouble for them. I mean, Joe's had his own trouble with his Cocker Spaniel, but I wanted to kind of go through this. He said, first of all, they want to communicate or connect with you based on how you smell. What matters to a dog about how the human smells, whether you've been around other dogs or, you know, what are they looking for when they look at how you smell?
Well, they certainly can smell whether you've been around other dogs, and they can smell, he's right, some things like being calm versus being stressed, being fearful. I don't know that they are always smelling this, but they have the capacity to smell, say, stress in a human.
How?
So if you come...
Hormones?
They can smell levels of hormones. Yeah, they have an organ above the mouth and below the nose called... very unlovely name for an organ called the vomeronasal organ or the Jacobson's organ. And this allows them to detect pheromones, basically hormones. And we are emitting these all the time. A lot of animals have the vomeronasal organ. There's actually some debate about whether humans do as well and just don't know how to access that information. So they can smell cortisol, stress hormone increases in humans, and presumably the lack of cortisol as well. So they can discover if you're calm or if you're fearful, and they might react accordingly. That's a little different than needing to be an assertive alpha presence with a dog. That the latest wolf research from wolves in the wild, from viewing wolves in the wild, indicates that the wolves operate in a pack, but as a family, not with dogs, as I say, vying to be the alpha male and with one dominant and the rest submissive. Parents in a family are in some way dominant over their children, but they're not alphas. And that's how wolves act. So I don't know if we need to use this kind of old model of wolf behavior that's been disproven.
But wolves run around and hunt. They live in the wild. I mean, we ask a lot of dogs to accommodate human environments and lifestyles and life paces, you might say. I mean, does that sort of bro or sis relationship with the dog work when, you know, we want a lot from a dog? We want certain behaviors from the dog, or many people do anyway.
Right. That's true. And I think in some sense... The more you look at what dogs want, what their life should be like, the less maybe we'd ask of them. And the more we ask of them that's human, maybe the more you do have to be a bit of a dominant presence. So in some sense, I'd say by looking at the dog's perspective or the dog's point of view, you might be developing relationships which ask a little less of dogs.
Have you done that with your dog, Pump, over time? Has your scientific research brought you to a different relationship with Pump based on all you know about him?
It really changed my relationship with Pumpernickel a lot to have observed other dogs. And I didn't really observe her scientifically, but then I started noticing a lot of elements of her life. And I asked a lot of different things from her when I realized what her experience might be. I also was forced, I think, to change my time with her. I realized how bored she could be, how much she really needs things to do when I'm away, how much of a social animal dogs are. And one of the elements of dog ownership that's difficult is that we leave our dogs alone for a huge amount of their life, and we sort of expect that that's okay. And as a matter of fact, they don't complain about it, or at least we don't hear about it. So we're kind of allowed to do that. But when you think about what's in the mind of this creature, it's very hard to leave a dog alone all day. And we're kind of obliged to try to find something for them to do, I think.
Let's go to Kathy in Fort Lauderdale, Florida on that front. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air with Alexander Horowitz.
Hi. Actually, you just answered my question to some extent. Thank you for taking my call. I have to leave my dog at different times for a full day of work, or when I travel, I leave her with a sitter, and I'm wondering how stressed that makes the dog. It sure stresses me out.
Works that way.
Well, I don't think you should be too stressed out. You're doing the right thing if you're leaving the dog with a sitter. I think having something to do doesn't have to be another animal or human to interact with, but maybe food to search for, a problem to solve. That's entertaining to a dog. That's diverting to a dog. Dogs that can socialize with other dogs when you're away, that's also a good diversion from just being at home and essentially awaiting your return. So the more things you can do, the better. Of course, remember too that dogs do sleep a lot more than we do, and it's all right to leave them and let them sleep for a few hours. We don't need to feel guilty every time we walk out the door.
Dogs may smell time, but can they sense the duration of time, a quantity of time? Do they have a sense of whether it's been 5 minutes or, you know, 5 hours?
That's a good question. I think that they can detect the difference, certainly. First of all, they learn the importance of the day or hours of the day as we see them through observing our behavior. So if you always leave for 3 hours and then one time you leave for 14, that's going to be qualitatively, in addition to quantitatively, different to the dog. And the dog will notice that. They also seem to be able to notice the passage of the day as marked through smell. So there might be some sense in which they can tell if it's just been a few minutes versus whether it's been the whole day that has passed since they've seen you, based on how the smells in a room, say, change over the course of a day.
Let's go to Rose in Plainville, Connecticut. Hi, Rose. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say, about 20 years ago, I had three dogs. I have one now. I've always had dogs. These dogs were so incredibly smart. I would get up every morning, and I would put on my sneakers, you know, get dressed. Some of the days, I would take them walking. And from my point of view, I got dressed the same way every morning. And yet, the days that I was going to take them walking, they went crazy. It just, I never could figure out what I did differently on the days I was going to take them walking.
Did you wear the same shoes, the same clothes, or
yeah,
every day?
Yeah, basically, well, yeah.
That's amazing. What about it, Alexander? Could they just feel Rose sort of physically gearing up for a walk somehow, or what do you reckon?
It's pretty likely that something about your intent was visible in your behavior. Now, I don't know exactly what it is, but actually we're slightly less good readers of intent of other humans than I think dogs are readers of our intent, because dogs really stare at us and observe us, and we're trained socially, culturally, not to stare at each other so much. But there probably was something slightly different in your manner, in your behavior, when you were going on these walk days and on the non-walk days, and the dogs are ready to pick up on that. There might have also been something hopeful in their excitement.
Yeah. Come on, let's do
it. Once in a while, that convinces you to have a walk. Yeah, but I think they're terrific at that, and it's interesting that you observed it.
Thanks, Rose. Glenn in Boston, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Well.
Good. Listen, I've been doing some light reading on the Stilton Tompkins affect system recently, and this one author makes some references to apes and dogs in terms of their affect systems and how similar they are to humans, and how shame plays a role in terms of attenuation and as a limit device for behavior. And I was just wondering in your research, how much you go into that.
Shame and dogs, Alexandra?
Actually, I don't think there is much research about shame in dogs or about many of the secondary emotions, so the emotions which are thought to be slightly more complicated than happiness and disgust.
Is the tail under the legs when something's been chewed? Is that shame or is that anthropomorphism?
Right. Well, as a matter of fact, I did do an experiment trying to test if the guilty look that we see in dogs, which is similar to a look of shame, expresses that they know that they've done something wrong. This is this look, right, with a tail under the legs or ears back or slinking away from the owner. And pretty much every owner I know, including myself, will interpret that as an understanding that they've disobeyed and they should feel guilty. So I did an experiment where I had owners forbid a dog to eat a treat and then leave the room. And in some cases, I allowed the dog to eat the treat. In other cases, I took it away and didn't allow them to eat the treat. And when the owners returned, I sometimes misinformed the owners. So I told them, gee, the dog had actually eaten the treat when he hadn't. And the owners lightly scolded their dogs if the dogs had disobeyed. So they told them no and so forth. What I was interested in is in which cases the dog showed the guilty look, in which cases they slunk away or put their tail between their legs and wagged it madly as they do. And it looked like they showed this guilty look not when they'd actually disobeyed and eaten the treat they'd been told not to, but instead when they were scolded or when they were about to be scolded by the owners. Does that mean that they didn't actually feel guilt at disobeying? Not exactly. It's hard to know if it's extremely hard to know whether they feel guilt or whether they feel shame. But the behavior, which looks like it maps to guilt, this guilty look actually maps to something else, which is anticipation of being scolded or anticipation of anger on the part of their owner, their person. So there's no evidence yet, one way or the other, about these secondary emotions, including shame and guilt.
We've only got a few seconds. I wonder, with all you've learned, Alexandra, if you end up feeling that you know dogs better or less well, given that you're exploring the depths of differences between humans and dogs here. Do they become more strange to you or better known?
In some way, I think I feel like we have a much more insecure foundation to talk about dogs than I thought. And in some way, looking at the science of dogs is about knowing the limitations about what we can ever know about another animal.
Well, ignorance may be bliss, but it feels like fun to learn more today. 300 million receptor sites in the nose of a beagle. That taught me something I didn't know, compared to 6 million for human smell. Alexandra Horowitz's new book is Inside of a Dog. It's been great to have you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.